oops, can we, I guess we'll have to do that over again. Can I do that over again?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll just edit the middle so you can start.
Okay.
All right. Let's do that again.
All right. Sorry about that. Okay, so there was a small technical glitch, but you are with the Oracle Hour right now. And this is Amanda Yates Garcia, and I'm here with Maya Grant.
Hello.
An amazing artist and performer. And we were just talking about her beginnings at this Institute for Cultural Inquiry, which is on Robertson, which is where I first met her, as a result of being led to her doorstep by Carol Shea, who also has a show here on Kaechung. And Maya was just telling us a little bit about her practice as in residency at the Institute. So
the Institute of Cultural Inquiry is sort of one of those little hidden treasures of Los Angeles. It's sort of a private library art collection. It was started by a group of artists in the 90s, and it just has all sorts of beautiful art books and weird esoteric literature and occult literature and a lot of philosophy. And they have visualist in residencies where artists or sometimes even scientists are invited to come and do visual research, use their collection to inform or enrich or inspire work.
Right.
Although the expectations of the residency aren't that you have to produce a piece, it's there really for you to just sort of soak up research and be deep in this research. And I applied to this residency because I've been doing for the past 4 years research into the history of spiritualism, mystics, gurus, inventors of weird spiritual forms of worship in early Southern California. So the 1890s to the 1920s, really when cities were being founded and coming into their initial shape, a huge shaping force were these mystics and gurus and people who were inventing for the first time these kind of collisions of Eastern and Western and science fiction. California was sort of providing the space for those kind of religions to grow. So it's always been, people think of Southern California or California as this place of like hippies and weird cults, and they think of the 60s. Mm-hmm. Or if they really go back, they think maybe of the 40s. But it's been in the blood of California from the beginning of white occupation.
Right, and maybe even before that. I mean, because with the Native Americans who lived here,
absolutely,
they had a very strong spiritual culture.
They had a spiritual practice, but the sort of synthesis and invention is very much from the turn of the 20th century. So they have a lot of literature there that responds to that, but it ended up, my research there ended up getting diverted in a wonderful way, in that as I was starting there,
when you were at the Institute,
when I was at the Institute of Cultural Inquiry this summer, as I was starting there, a friend of the Institute, her mother is very old, and I think she's dying, and she had been involved in Dianic Wicca, and she'd been involved in feminist witch practices in Southern California, and she donated her entire library to the Institute as I was starting. And they just gave me a lot of these books, and so it sort of diverted my research to this particular world of feminist occult inquiry, which of course I'm going to respond to anyway. It was like a really magical collision.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you were already really interested in early Californian spiritual practices, but then sort of through this sort of kind of sounds like kind of a tragic serendipity in
yes.
that it was
yes.
the result of someone's illness, but that she had brought in this huge library of
Dianic
Wicca.
Boxes.
Can you tell us a little bit, for our listeners who maybe don't know very much about Dianic Wicca, what you found out about it and what you were interested in?
Well, Dianic Wicca is a practice of Wicca that is women only. And it was started in the 60s by a woman who called herself Z. Budapest, mm-hmm. Who was a woman from Hungary and started this sort of worship, Wiccan worship, and responding to a lot of the sort of reemergence of Wicca that was happening in the 60s and 70s, created a kind of all-female coven. A lot of the work was connected to things happening by Starhawk, although she came a little later. And a lot of the books that I was getting were books by Starhawk, who's an amazing witch, feminist writer,
activist.
Wiccan writer, activist, just incredible.
Permaculturist.
An exquisite writer.
Yeah, an exquisite writer.
Like, I think people think, oh, Starhawk, like, skeptical people, like, oh, Starhawk, some Bay Area. Like, her writing is lucid and precise and so beautiful. So it was like all of Starhawk's books, a bunch of specifically Dianic Wiccan books. And one thing that I was realizing about reading these things about, a lot of this stuff would happen through, this is the history of witch practices, the history of witchcraft. A lot of these books were kind of a major way to disseminate feminism in almost this sneaky way. Like in one of the books, there was a ceremony. It was a book of a mail order class. You would like do this mail order class and every week get in the mail the next lesson of how to do like feminist spiritual ceremonies.
Yeah.
And then it was compiled as a book and printed. And one of the ceremonies was like a ceremony for if you've been raped.
Right,
and at the end of the ceremony, at the end of this description of how you do the ceremony, it said, you are beautiful, it's not your fault, may patriarchy fall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredible. And I don't think that in a general feminist political conversation,
mm-hmm.
you can say may patriarchy fall without sounding like you're some extremist. But somehow the spiritualist context allowed a lot of women to receive some very radical political thinking.
Yeah.
And that was like really blew my mind.
Yeah, I think that's really amazing. And you're touching on something that I think is so important about like spiritual practice in the arts, particularly as practiced by women or like Wicca or magic or from sort of Dianic rites in that way, is that like historically that those kinds of practices have been like a bastion for feminism. And I feel like when people are critical of magical practices, they don't understand that they're also kind of being that in a lot of ways, I feel like there is a critique of feminism going on there. Not that I'm saying that all feminists are interested in magical rites or anything, but these kinds of practices are very feminist in nature, and that like criticizing like magic and spiritual beliefs is in a way critical of women, in the sense that like people are often saying like, oh, astrology, that's what women are into, and as if that makes it A, somehow lame, and B, somehow like not as worthy a pursuit. And I'm always thinking, well, if so many women are interested in it, then maybe there's something to it, maybe there's something interesting about it.
I think there's definitely, all of these practices are a challenge to Judeo-Christian patriarchy, that I think even if you're an atheist or you're not religious, like it has deeply informed Western culture. So yeah, these practices are explicitly and implicitly and sometimes subversively and quietly a challenge to that. And that challenges people. That challenges, and when you're talking about it in art practices, it challenges ideas of male genius. It challenges a lot of ideas that actually, the idea of the male genius, I think, is very connected to sort of a Judeo-Christian structure of the great male leader. Like, yeah.
Well, yeah, is, like the word of God
coming
through.
Yeah, the word of God coming through this prophet.
Through
like,
a prophet who just always happens to
actually,
be male.
Actually, one of the last pieces that I did, I was a theater director for 10 years before I started making visual art, before I started making video.
So you must have started when you were like 5.
Yeah, well.
Because you're very accomplished.
Thank you. It doesn't feel that way sometimes, but The last piece that I did was an adaptation of Bible stories in clown, using the like performance language of clown, like Chaplin clown. And it was a way of retelling the Bible as this sort of running gag about masculinity and failure. Because all of these men...
That's amazing. I have like to see that.
Given
Is that on your website?
It is on my website. It's these men, these male prophets or kings are given power, and then they fuck up. And it's like this fantastic... And it's hilarious. I mean, even the story that I think I need to readapt in more of the visual art context, because it still haunts me, is the story of Saul, who's the first king of Israel. And in the Bible, he throws a spear at David and misses, and then he throws a spear at David and misses, and then he falls on his spear. It's like a comic 1-2-3.
It's Monty Python.
Absolutely.
And that's where they got their idea.
And it's very, yeah, absolutely.
Which is true.
And so I feel like there is something very challenging to it. And actually, as someone who... I don't engage in Wicca. I don't have this kind of personal...
Right, like you said that, in fact, you're an atheist, right?
Yeah, I was raised by Israeli atheists who are like, all organized religion is bullshit, and that's how I was raised. It's many generations of my family have believed in that. It's almost like our science is almost our religion. Mm-hmm. But I am always thinking about what is the profound human need for worship. Mm-hmm. I think that there is the way in which organized religion wants to control us, but it can do so because there is a true human yearning for spiritual experience. I feel like it's biological. I feel like the need goes so deeply in our bodies. And so I'm always thinking about that need, that very physical embodied need.
Yeah, so
and
what
yearning.
Do you think that's about? Why do you think why would we have this yearning and need, do you think? Or have you come up with an answer in all of these studies and research?
I don't know that I've come up with an answer. I think that I just I respect it. It's a way to I think that my family always I remember my mom saying to me, because she saw that I was more of a spiritual person, and she would say to me, "You're not going to join a cult, are you?" Like, I mean, as in so far as art is a cult,
right,
yes,
I'm for sure.
Obviously have joined that cult. But it was really, she was really nervous about that. And I feel like there's something, and yet she loves art. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's where she gets that kind of connection or release.
But it's interesting, isn't it, this idea of belief and what that even means in the context of like these spiritual practices, because like, for example, in relation to Dianic Wicca or any kind of Wicca, or we were talking before the show started about Jack Parsons and his participation in various thelemic magical rites, like where the question of belief comes in, because in magical practices, it's well known that you don't have to believe. There's no requirement for belief. It's a practice, in the same way that you don't have to believe in the redeeming qualities of art to be an artist. Like you just practice art, and that is what makes you an artist. You can believe as ardently as you want in art and never practice it and not be an artist.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, so I think that idea of belief is really interesting, because when we think about, like, for example, we believe in science, or there's so many cultural beliefs that we ascribe to that are completely invisible to us. But when it comes to spiritual beliefs, whatever that might mean, what I think is kind of a vague term, but when we're talking about these beliefs, like, are we talking about like gods and goddesses? Are we talking about their ability to intervene on behalf of?
Are we talking about forces that are too great for our understanding, and this is a lens through which we can attach to like a tiny fragment of it?
I mean, really, it's about our pattern making. Like, I mean, if there is a physiological component to spiritual belief, it seems to be that humans are pattern-making machines, and that we ascribe some kind of pattern and meaning to...
Well, and that's what's so interesting about one of the groups that I've been looking at from early Southern California are the Theosophists.
Right.
And they're... One of the things that's so fascinating about them is that they were huge. There were so many theosophists. Many, many thousands of people followed theosophy in America.
Yeah.
It was a major practice. And theosophy is the study of religions, and you see that it's almost one of the side effects of colonialism, that all of these colonialist countries, people were going to India and China and, you know, raping and pillaging and plundering these nations and these lands and these peoples. And they were also going, oh, wow, they have religions that have nothing to do with ours, that have existed totally in parallel to Judeo-Christian practices for thousands of years. And the theosophists said, oh, well, maybe if we study all of them next to each other, we can find the pattern, we can crack the code.
Right.
And that, I think in a lot of ways, it was a very unfundamentalist time. You could be a Christian and then go be part of the Self-Realization Fellowship, and it wasn't the same thing as you get right now with fundamentalist Christians or fundamentalist Jews, that you, like, how dare you engage in pagan practices or read Harry Potter. Like, it was a time where everything kind of mixed, and maybe because they didn't feel threatened by these other religions, because whiteness and Judeo-Christian practices were still so dominant.
Right.
But the theosophists were absolutely doing that. They were trying to sort of take this meta view and see if they could sort of look down at all of it and find the bigger patterns by looking at all these things next to each other.
Mm, and theosophy had quite a few female leaders, didn't it?
And the two biggest leaders in Southern California, they were kind of not warring, but it wasn't, I don't know that it was as strong as warring theosophist sects, but they were definitely competing theosophist sects. There was Catherine Tingley in San Diego, who is known as the Purple Mother, and she started a theosophist commune in Point Loma, the buildings of which now belong to a Catholic college, Point Loma School of the Nazarene. So you can still go down because some of the architecture is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was like they grew their own food. They developed this kind of proto-Montessori system for schooling kids.
And yeah, there were children were very much involved.
Huge.
Through female leadership of religious institutions.
And then there was Annie Besant, who was the other one, who was the L.A. and then Ojai, who in Hollywood had the Crotona colony. She came from England, and she was very involved in India self rule. Like, she was very, like, she's a big socialist, she was a friend of George Bernard Shaw, and then she became a theosophist and started in LA and then moved to Ojai, where her center still is. So I encourage everyone to go to the Theosophist Center in Ojai, the library there. If you're interested in this kind of stuff, you can spend many very pleasurable hours. And her Jiddu Krishnamurti, who was this big guru, who is Annie Besant's protege, he ended up living in Ojai, and his house is still there. So
he was her protege. I didn't know that.
They found him. He was a street kid in India.
That's right. I knew about that. And I knew that he had been sort of brought up to sort of see himself to see himself as some sort of a deep guru, but then he decided that he didn't want to.
But then he paradoxically became the guru of Think for Yourself.
Right.
So he was still a guru, but he was the Think for Yourself guru.
So spiritualism, theosophy is just like capitalism in that you can't really escape. You try and
you can't.
And you just end up being the guru of non-gurus.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was Annie Besant and this guy, Charles Ledbetter, who was like a pederast. I mean, he was like a pedophile. He would go to India and totally exploit these children. And one of the children that they picked up was Jiddu Krishnamurti, who then became the anti-guru.
Well, so was he exploited by this man?
I've researched that, and I haven't been able to find a definitive answer. There's just the knowledge that Charles Ledbetter was a big pervert and lover of young boys.
That's heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, and yet weirdly part of the sort of male Oxford academic homo culture. Like, it was sort of part of that narrative because it was like being like the Greeks.
And
that was like a way of initiating young boys and all this not to in any way excuse it,
right.
But there is a weird, freaky cultural context for that kind of perversion in Victorian.
Yes. Well, in that kind of everywhere. There's always justifications, right? But I don't want to go too far down that road, though I do think it is an interesting one to peruse, because I'm wanting to know a little bit more about how all these investigations and this really substantial amount of research that you've been doing relates to your practice as an artist.
I think
maybe you could tell us a little bit about, just like as a way of grounding that, because I know that that's kind of a big question, in the ritual that I saw at the ICI.
Yeah. So at the ICI, it was just a small ritual to celebrate the vernal equinox, the autumnal equinox, the autumnal equinox. And it was just an invented one. I mean, I just felt like if I was supposed to do a sort of end of residency performance or end of residency showing, mm-hmm. the best way to show it would be to invent a ritual and then engage people in it. And we made a circle. We read aloud various forms of witch knowledge from a book about Italian witchcraft from that had been translated in the late 19th century by a compatriot of Barnum, of like
P.T.
Barnum, yeah. One of his compatriots ended up moving to Italy and translated this, what he said was this book of Italian witchcraft, although it's never been quite clear if the witch who he had been engaged with was just making it up. It was like this Italian folklore.
Which is kind of the truth about, like, at least most neo...
Absolutely.
Neo-pagan or Wiccan, if it can be called that practice, that we never really know whether or not it's true. And it's my opinion that it doesn't really matter.
Absolutely. Which is why I had everybody read pieces of wisdom from that. We ate pomegranate seeds. One of the things that I was... I think one of the biggest metaphors that I've been wrestling with since the residency is that in the Eleusinian Mysteries, which was an ancient Greek mystery cult and ceremony that people would participate in, the central fable was that of Persephone going to the underworld and Demeter searching for her. And a lot of feminist writers in the 60s, like Adrienne Rich, wrote about it, about this as an origin myth, the myth of the daughter being raped and the mother attempting to correct it.
Right.
And that was incredibly powerful to me, the idea of centering that as an origin myth. So we ate pomegranate seeds, we went outside attached to a rope, we purified the space with salt, we burned our panes for the year. It was we left the men in the first part of the room because they weren't
allowed.
That
was really amazing and surprising, because we started off in your studio space and did all these ritualistic practices and did the readings and ate the pomegranate seeds
and apples and
the apples, and then you did a ceremonial dance, and then we all sort of held onto a rope and went outside, but the men had to stay inside holding a rope.
Yeah,
and it was such a great way of sort of visualizing or somaticizing exclusion, and so surprising. It really shocked me. I was like, oh, you guys just have to stay in here,
you don't get to
find out what happens. And they were really good sports about it, but it really provoked me into thinking about the whole history of, well, spiritual and cultural practices and culture in general throughout the world, and how exclusion is built into it at every step.
And it's one of the things in terms of translating a lot of this research into pieces, into actual works and videos and performances, I'm thinking a lot about, and I have been for a really long time, about women's knowledge and women's wisdom and women's experience, and what it means to ritualize it, to turn it into a rite, to put that knowledge in the forefront, not necessarily to spill all of its secrets, but in some ways to make it visible but still make it a little bit obscure, and to put women's experience really deeply in the center of things. I think a lot of my pieces end up, especially in the past few years, end up being about that. And it's a very, like, in some ways, like, old school feminism. But as I get older, I find that as a feminist, I'm only angrier. Like, I was a very angry young feminist. And then
too.
I was like, whatever, I'm going to listen to the Beastie Boys and I'm over it because I'm a feminist and it's cool. And like, And then as I get older, I get angry again. And
what makes you angry?
I don't know. I feel like I think that there's a feeling of inevitability of certain tropes of womanhood that feel like unavoidable, or here they come again, or oh my God, like I've spent my whole life fighting this and all of a sudden I'm...
And are you meaning in the culture at large or in the world around you, or are you seeing that inside yourself?
Absolutely, both. Right. Both.
I know, I find that too, that like as much as I fight sort of patriarchy in theory in the world, I find it just growing in my own mind like the most voracious weeds,
and you're constantly
having to pull them out.
Like, I'm married, I have a child, and there are certain things that I'm like, oh my God, this is happening to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like
what specifically?
Oh God, like, this is such a small little one, but it so resonates with me. And if my husband is listening, I love you very much, honey. But I remember I'm kind of naturally a slob, but my husband's a real neatnik.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved in together, all of a sudden I was the one who was always cleaning up, and not just cleaning up my shit, because I'm the slob, cleaning
right.
up his.
Right, and I'm sure with a child.
And, like, and his neatness all of a sudden dictated our life, but he no longer participated in it. All of a sudden it was my job.
Right.
And I was like, wait, what? Well, hold on a second.
How
the fuck did this happen that I'm the one? What?
Yeah.
And it's such a little thing, and obviously we manage it, and
right.
it's fine, but it's insidious.
Mm.
And every woman I talk to who is in a long-term relationship with a man who has some kind of feminist awareness notices these certain things where certain, even when, like, my husband is a profoundly feminist, evolved human, like more so than many people. He's an incredibly involved, evolved and involved dad. He's as equal as a partner as you could ever hope for. But certain things feel very insidious and unavoidable.
Yeah.
And it's really deep. I'm starting to like age in Southern California. All of a sudden,
which
these
is really hard,
really weird and creepy
for me. That's the hardest. Like, things revolving around like aging, like, and beauty, and like physical body. And like, it's really relentless.
I grew up in Southern California. I fought these when I was a young person. I fought these things, and here I am subject to them again.
Yeah.
And it's like the work doesn't end. And so there are ways, even I was thinking about like all of the sort of tradition of like, oh, my wife jokes and comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the huge context of women, it sounds so silly, but women's experience that would totally fucking put a dagger in those male jokes if
yeah.
they were ever spoken. Like,
right, like you mean that if a woman were to respond to actually, honestly to
yeah, about like, well, why is it that way?
Yeah, 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 right, yeah.
Why?
Like
why?
The whole nagging, oh, that, yeah, that's
nagging
something.
Wife.
My husband also is very egalitarian and a feminist and amazing person in general, but he does often think that I'm nagging him, and I don't want to, but like it has to do with the fact that like if I ask him to do something more than once and it needs to be done, you know, but and it's really weird because we find ourselves falling into that, and the word nag will happen and we'll both be like, where is this coming from?
It's like this thing that I saw. I was driving by the Grove. I was on 3rd Street, and I drove by the Grove, and there's this big billboard where it says, women blink twice as much as men. And it's, and so that makes you think of fast blinking, like,
yeah.
And I was like, well, what if it said men blink half as much as women?
Right.
And then it would be like, boom, boom. Like, there's a way in which that that is always present. That is always present as something to think about. So I think about what would rituals around female experience be? What would they look like? What would the experience be that would be celebrated? What would those things be?
Well, and I think that's so interesting because it sort of circles back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that when we think about like what would rituals be for women, and we're thinking about that within the context of a, you know, an art practice, because you're not like a practicing pagan. This is specifically an art practice,
absolutely,
a ritual art practice. And yet there's something about that that makes it, that seems very like, as we were talking about earlier, that sort of like granola, sort of crunchy, like 80s, 90s feminism.
But I guess that, I'm not worried about it because my work is so not granola.
Right.
It's just like,
no, I know. Absolutely. But I'm more like saying, like, how can we explain to people who maybe, like, I feel like a lot of people don't, like, when they hear the idea of like ritual or like feminist ritual or women's practices, I mean, is it just my imagination that people like start rolling their eyes?
No, it's not. And it's something I've worked hard at in terms of my own self-hate about that. But I also think that if the piece is savage enough, if it's difficult enough, if it's like, I don't know, I think that it's in the same way when you say that, I know that something that I fight against, because my background is, I was a dancer and then I was a theater director for 10 years. And there's this way in which there's also like, oh, theater.
Right.
Because my stuff is very like staged. It is. It's like staged. There's things that happen in an order, and it's not chaos. I think that the aesthetic of authenticity, it's like one of my colleagues calls it the tyranny of authenticity, like having really awkward performance on video, because that somehow means that it's like realer, like when you're really awkward for the camera. And I think that's horseshit. It's all a construction.
Right.
You're just choosing to construct that, like, oh, I'm so awkward in front of the camera. I'm really, this, I'm so way more real.
Right.
Like, I'm not interested in the tyranny of authenticity. My stuff is super constructed, but there's that same, in the same way that you would say, oh, feminist ritual practices, you also that kind of weird theatrical feminist, it's not hip. It's not what's hip in art. Also, what's not hip in art is like anger. I think especially anger from women.
Right.
I think being obsessive is super hip. That's super hip in art. I took my a piece of my hair and I used it to paint 7,000 grains of rice, and then I like stabbed myself in the eye with it. Like, that's super. That's going on. But being fucking angry, that's shrill nagging.
Right.
That's exactly. So I feel like there's definitely I'm always going to be fighting the eye roll. Like,
right,
my work is theatrical. I'm always going to be fighting the
but
eye
maybe
roll.
Maybe every artist is always fighting the eye roll, and it seems like,
sure.
I mean, like who is making work that people don't roll their eyes at, and why is it that some artists get a total sort of free pass? I don't know. I feel like
I think for sure one of the art pieces, and I talked to my students about this, and it was a piece that I actually responded to the performance, like the fact that I don't think it's ever been properly acknowledged that Drawing Restraint by Matthew Barney is totally ripped off from Carolee Schneeman up to and including Her Limits. And I feel like I could say that Drawing Restraint is a response, but he's never acknowledged it as a response. Like, she tied herself up with the, you know, tree harness and like painted and put these restraints on herself. And then he did the same thing, but it was very much in the framework of like, I'm an Ubermensch. And I just need to put all of these bungee cords on myself to like fight my unbelievable, unstoppable creative power.
Right.
Which is like completely the opposite of that. And so I was doing a movement performance piece where it became like a movement game where I was dancing in a way where I was being stopped from making a mark by two performers.
It was very brutal.
Yeah, and then so I fight two people until I can make a mark, and the first person has to stand there. I fight the other person until I can make a mark, and then I fight myself until I can make a mark.
Right.
And I feel like that's part of this conversation.
Mm.
That's part of this conversation about like the feminist work versus the Ubermensch genius work.
Right. Well, and that sort of goes back to another thing that we were talking about before we went on the air, which was that Cameron show, and we were talking about with the work that she was making. We were talking about the work that Jack Parsons was making as a scientist, and I'm trying to think now why I was thinking that that actually related to what we were saying, but I feel like
it
does.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
We'll just go there anyway. Moving on to Jack Parsons and Cameron. So I was just thinking, could you talk a little bit about, because what we were saying was really interesting about how your work is about failure, and then Jack Parsons is sort of considered a failure at magic.
Well, what I love about Jack Parsons, and this is something that's brought up in his biographies, is that, so Jack Parsons, for those who are listening who might not know, was one of the founders of Jet Propulsion Laboratories. He was like a rich boy, grew up in Pasadena. His family lost all their money in the crash in the Great Depression. And he was always obsessed with explosive and rockets when those things were like crazy talk, when people who were interested in that like they were interested in science fiction.
Like literally they read Jules Verne and people were like, you guys are like silly nerds.
It wasn't considered science.
Right.
And then it started to be considered science.
Yeah.
And he was incredibly influential for the creation of solid state fuel, of like the kind of fuel that gets rockets to the moon.
Right.
He is responsible for that. He was also this like major occultist, Aleister Crowley follower, also a huge fan of science fiction, and he had a little run with L. Ron Hubbard,
right,
and like all the before Scientology, and just an interesting character. Anyway, Jack Parsons is remembered as this musician and not so much as a scientist, but he was actually quite a brilliant scientist and quite a failed magician. All of his ceremonies that he would try to make happen never manifested, and he knew that, and he was incredibly like ashamed of that. And like Aleister Crowley would write letters to their fellow OTO members and be like, what the fuck is Jack Parsons doing? Like, he's somebody's got to control that boy. And he sort of had this out of control drug use, and he because he lived such this wild decadent life, he got cut off from all these science avenues. So at the end of his life, he was like making explosives for B movies, and like,
oh, right.
So he
and he blew himself up.
He blew himself up,
and nobody really knows exactly what.
There are different theories. I mean, he was a very sweaty man, apparently, so it's possible that the thing he was mixing...
He dropped fulminated mercury onto the floor,
but
and
there's
it exploded.
Also, at some point, he had testified in a trial against this mobster just as an expert witness.
Right.
So that's sometimes thought is, you know, was part of it. And he had this weird relationship with his mom, and she killed herself the day that he died.
Yeah,
and,
right. She found out that he died.
And then he
claims that he had like Oedipal longings for his mother by his own admission.
And he's somebody who I think people are like, oh, he's this crazy scientist who did all these sex magic rituals, but it was actually, nothing ever kind of worked out for him. He's kind of, the more you learn about him, he's kind of this like incredibly brilliant, lovable loser who just kind of fucked up a lot. And I feel like, and so what the book noted is, and he's never Because he was so nuts, a lot of the scientists who'd initially worked for him and benefit from his genius as a scientist never gave him his proper due as a scientist.
Right. Because he had all these fringe beliefs as well.
Fringe beliefs and crazy sex parties.
Yeah,
and
right. That they just couldn't go there with him.
Happening around McCarthy era. And people were like, no, we're not interested in that.
And then his relationship with Cameron, you were talking about that a lot, which was really interesting. She was like kind of...
Treated him like shit. Yeah, she treated him terribly. And I think like almost...
I saw her picture, you know, I was looking at her pictures a lot while I was at the show, and I was like, I'm so fascinated by her, but like I don't want to know her.
Well,
like
she was incredibly gorgeous and magnetic, and I think in her later life as she made work around this stuff and she was this figure as Jack Parsons' wife, like people sort of elevated her, but she was kind of skeptical in the beliefs, and I think she went along with him, you know, when they first got together, they were going to produce a moon child. I think she went along with it because it was kind of sexy. She moved to Mexico, had all these affairs, like left him, treated him like shit.
Like a year after they got married, she moved to Mexico.
So I feel like...
by herself.
Like Marjorie Cameron, like even in their relationship, she was completely the one in control and that kind of left him there to have a bunch of sad affairs and like, you know, do a bunch of amphetamines. Like
But I wonder what it was about her. Like, cause at that time she was like, what, 23. She'd just gotten out of the Navy. She'd moved there from Iowa. Well, she'd grown up in Iowa and then she went into the Navy and then she ended up, she was like a fashion drawer, like illustrator. And I wonder what it was. Like he saw her and he was like, she's the one.
Well, she had red hair.
She was very beautiful, very striking.
And I think the Scarlet Woman and the idea that she was going to have red hair was huge.
Right.
He owned this house, and when he was flush with cash, it was sort of this... He made it the center for writers and weirdos and artists to kind of live together and hang out.
Yeah.
And people were always coming through and they were having parties. And it was like a constant salon of these wonderful weirdos. And she just showed up one day at the house and they saw each other. And like she didn't leave his bedroom for 2 weeks.
Right.
It was like a crazy, crazy love affair.
Mm.
It was like crazy in love circa... 1940. and that was, I think that was part of the appeal. She was uninhibited and wild and young and beautiful. And I think he felt like he'd found someone who could keep up with his hungers and desires.
But it was interesting though, because she wasn't into magic. And then he spotted her and he was like, you are Babylon incarnate.
Yes.
And she eventually was like, yeah, I am. I am Babylon incarnate.
I kind of love that.
I know.
But she really
rose to that,
absolutely.
You know, and lived it.
I know. I would like how often does that happen that somebody says, you're Babylon incarnate? You're like, all right, if that's what I must be,
I will be. Because actually, they weren't actually together for very long.
Not at all.
And then he died. But she continued making work about angels and ectoplasm and fascinated by Carl Jung and writing letters to him, Carl Jung and
being in Kenneth Anger's movies and totally.
Well, so we're sort of reaching the end and I feel like there's so much more that I want to...
We just started.
I know. There's so much more I want to find out about you and your practice. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, just as we can sort of...
So all of my projects right now are kind of around this constellation of this research that I've been doing, and they're taking different forms. One of the pieces that I'm writing right now, I had done a piece called The Whore's Dialogue, which uses as its base... there's an extinct form of pornography called the Whore's Dialogue, which was like the dominant form of written pornography in Europe from like the Renaissance up till the end of the Victorian era, where porn would take the form of pornography. It's like whore's writing, and porn would take the form of the older woman telling the younger woman what to do.
Right. So
like,
all
this is what it's going to be.
Right.
And so I did a video installation in which I had three mature actresses do this incredibly pornographic text. And sort of responding to that. It was a multi-channel kind of immersive installation. And there's another ceremony that I found that I'm writing a script on, which is there was a ceremony that was like a coming-of-age ceremony for young boys in ancient Greece, in which they would reenact the sending of the youth and virgins to be eaten by the Minotaur. Mm-hmm. And the only women who were allowed to participate were the Deipnephoroi, who brought food and were there to reenact the mothers who were sending their children to be eaten by the Minotaur.
Right.
By telling comforting stories, and that's their job. And that seemed like, in the same way that the Horus dialogue was like an amazing form to explore these ideas of sex and erotic narratives, the Deipnephoroi, to me, sending their children off to be eaten by a terrible monster and having to find words to comfort their children is an incredible...
That would be hard to find the right words in that circumstance.
It's an incredible metaphor for me to explore sort of languages of maternalism.
Right.
And I've been looking at things like ways that suicide bombers are convinced of doing what they're doing, or a lot of this stuff happening in Ferguson, like the sort of talk that Black parents have with their children about like all of these sort of rituals of sending somebody off, of parenting
child for the
for
world,
the horrors of the world. So, so that's something I'm writing right now to shoot this year, and then I'm working on a piece about Elisa Lam, mm-hmm. who was a woman who was found dead in a water tank at the top of a kind of Fleabag hotel in downtown LA last year. And I'm sure many of you have seen this video on YouTube. The last known footage of her is elevator surveillance of her having what appears to be a psychotic break in an elevator, and her movement is just exquisite and strange. And I've taught it to myself as choreography. I've learned it as choreography, and I'm using that movement as a template in which to dig, like finding the movement under the movement under the movement, to create a movement video piece using her. Her physical language in this moment of madness as kind of the base template to locate movement. So
that sounds incredible. And I did see a bit of it that you're showing us at the ICI, and it was amazing. So everybody will have to stay tuned and check out Maya's website,
which
is www.mayagurantz.com, mayagurantz.com. And check it out. Thank you so much, Maya, for coming
in. Oh, my pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. And I think you have a song that we're going to try and play.
Talk about some 1960s awesome feminist folk music. Let's plug it in. It's the last song, okay. Used to Think, by Erica Pomerantz, who's like Canadian documentary filmmaker and artist and musician. And she did like one crazy record, and it's awesome. So...
Yeah, so I think we're going.
Press the green and then...
Yeah, I think it should work. Oh, I think you need to... We're high tech around here. There we go.
There we go. Erica Pomerantz. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much, Amanda.